Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Robin Clapp from the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance and me, Tony Gosling. Well, they sign the PFI deals, but where are the finance directors and trustees when the trust can't afford to pay? Private Finance Initiative, or PFI, might like seem like the answer to our dreams. With a government strapped for cash, it enables public bodies to build the things they can't afford and pay for them over a decade or so. But how much does it cost? And with massive PFI deal just nearly finished at Southmead Hospital here in Bristol, why has one London NHS trust that went down the PFI route gone bankrupt? Plus, the US-owned First Group, who prompted passenger revolts here on the Paddington service, pip Virgin trains to the post, with Richard Branson saying the system's unfair. BCFM's Steve Satan pops in. He's national spokesperson for Rail Futures. But last but not least, the lady who took on the landmines industry and lost. We've all been waiting for an easy-to-read definitive book on the Diana assassination. Well, at 160 pages, it's arrived this week. It's called The Paris-London Connection. But like the evidence of this establishment murder, reported virtually nowhere in the British mainstream press. So, they sign the PFI deals, but where are the finance directors and trustees when the trust can't afford to pay? I'm joined by a PFI consultant on the line now, Dexter Whitfield. Hi, Dexter. Welcome to Drive Time. Now, first of all, Dexter, people that sign the deals are rarely around to deal with the consequences. Why is that?
Well, I think there's two reasons. One is that they take such a long time to come to fruition from the time an outline business case is developed to the completion of a procurement process and the start of construction. Sometimes you're talking, in terms of a large scheme like Southmead, you're talking, you know, probably 8 years between the start and the finish of that process before anything actually, you know, starts operating within that contract. So that's quite a long time. And the other key thing is that a lot of the people who are involved in these projects are into climbing the ladder. So they get one PFI contract under their belt and they then move on to other projects.
Okay, what do you know about the PFI contract at Southmead Hospital then? I mean, we've been hearing here in Bristol over the last week or so that there's talks about merging the trusts and cutting at least one A&E, at least partly, to pay for this PFI.
Well, I haven't heard any details about that, but I wouldn't be surprised at that. I mean, you know, this is a particular issue with very large PFI projects. I mean, Southmead, the capital cost of Southmead is something like £445 million. But what the trust is going to pay Carillion and the Halifax Bank of Scotland over the next 30 years is, according to my calculations, over £2.1 billion. So, and all that money, the £2.1 billion, is not borrowed money by the public sector. It's going to come out of the revenue budget of the NHS Trust, and this is why South London and five other trusts are in real financial difficulties, because that money is coming out of a revenue budget. And you know, some of the larger PFI projects, those trusts are paying 15-18% of their revenue budget just to pay for the PFI project.
Now, I'm doing my sums here, Dexter, and that looks, I mean, you're talking about roughly £500 million project, and you're talking about actually paying £2.1 billion for it. Now, that is actually four times, it's costing us four times what we're actually getting for the money.
Yeah, and now, I mean, that includes, you know, the 30 years of the facilities management that the contract will include. But it also includes, much more importantly, the high borrowing costs, the high financial costs that, you know, the private that are incurred by the private sector.
So, I mean, there is one positive thing there that you're saying, that as part of that money, you're actually getting the company. I mean, it's obviously not Carillion, because they're doing, I would imagine, they're doing the actual building. Who is it that's actually going to be servicing and looking after the property for the next 30 years then?
I don't know, have a detail of that. It might well be a Carillion subsidiary, because that's what happens. I mean, Interserve, Kia, all the big companies, Balfour Beatty, all have their own facilities management companies. So they come in, they build the hospital, and then a subsidiary does, runs the hospital. But I'm not absolutely clear in Southmead case, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case.
Okay, tell us a bit about Carillion. It's certainly them in this case. Who are these people?
Well, Carillion is one of the Britain's largest construction companies. And like other construction companies like Balfour Beatty and Interserve and Kier, when PFI came along, they moved into that into a big way. I mean, the worrying thing about Southmead is that, you know, Carillion is involved, and Carillion has a track record of building hospitals, and large hospitals at that, and then exiting them. So in 4 or 5 years' time, I would forecast in 5 years' time, Carillion would not own 50% of the equity of the operating company, which is going to operate, you know, the hospital, because their track record is that they sell the equity and make a very substantial profit on it. For example, they owned three hospitals. Well, they had a major stake in three hospitals: the Great Western in Swindon, one in Stoke, and another in Glasgow. And they sold the equity, the shares in the operating company that was set up to develop the project, after 5 years, and they made a virtually 100% profit on it. And I'd put money. I'm not a gambling person, but I'd put money that in 5 years' time, the same will happen in Southmead.
Now, you say that these projects are manager-driven and that there are sort of some people who are kind of career driving their careers along on this. What does that mean? I mean, surely at the end of the day, it's actually the NHS Trust Board that makes the final decision, isn't it? So it doesn't matter whether it's manager-driven or not. These are the people that actually make that decision.
Yes, I mean, yes, in theory. But, I mean, the problem is that these projects are so large. I mean, the Trust is, in a sense, signing a contract worth £2.1 billion. The documentation for this, you know, will run sky high in terms of paper, and never mind the ability of the Trust members to actually understand what is going on. And this is happening right across the country, where I would argue that they are really manager driven. The managers don't make the final decision, absolutely right, but those Trust members who are making the final decision really don't know very much about it, because it is just so goddamn complex.
Now, okay, so yes, I can certainly understand that, but I mean, what has been going on up till now? I mean, this PFI business, surely if there are some real serious problems with it, it would have been knocked on the head a long time ago, because it seems that there certainly are schools, hospitals. What kind of projects are going on, and have you any idea how much PFI is going on right now?
Well, there are nearly 750 PFI projects around the country, from, you know, schools, hospitals, prisons, defence establishments, barracks, prison, police stations, you name it, there's a PFI. And, you know, you're absolutely right, I totally agree, that in a sense, I was with together myself and a number of people when, you know, Labour government came into power in 1997. There was announced a review of PFI, and everybody thought, oh, a review, because there'd been a lot of opposition to it. Everybody thought that the review meant that we're going to change it, and to restructure it and whatever. But in fact, it was quite the opposite. We were all misled. What actually happened was their interest was in speeding it up. So what we've had is two decades of or different governments who are completely embedded, you know, in PFI, and who have not really, nobody's really lifted the lid and looked at it. And it's only now, when there's been more and more scandals, that the government is talking about, you know, another model. But I'm being very cynical and having, you know, worked on PFI issues and being opposed to the whole model of PFI for the last 20 years, whatever the new model is, I think it's going to look very similar to the one that we've already got.
Now, Dexter, give us a little bit of an idea about your expertise. Where are you coming from on this? You're saying you're against the PFI, but who are you and what's your expertise on this?
Who am I? Well, I'm director of the European Service and Strategy Unit. I'm visiting professor at the University of Adelaide in Australia. I've worked on PFI projects, working with sometimes local authorities, but mainly with on behalf of trade unions, community organisations, on a whole raft of different PFI projects over those 20 years. And also, I've been doing a whole lot of, a number of research projects on PFI, and it was, you know, I was the one who raised the whole issue about PFI, the sale of PFI equity, which in a sense was discussed by the Treasury Accounts Committee, the Public Accounts Committee, and the Treasury Committee last year, and that whole issue is now in the public realm. I've also been looking at, I mean, what the UK government has also done is, in a sense, exported PFI. And I wrote a book a couple of years ago called the Global Auction of Public Assets, where PFI has, in a sense, been sold, the idea of it has been sold to various countries around the world. And there's been a stream of visitors coming into the Treasury in London to look at the British model. And so it's not just a problem in Britain, there's also a problem, in a sense, developing in other countries as well, because we've copied the same model.
The trouble is, though, Dexter, of course, we wouldn't be able to have our nice hospital at Southmead, this one that's nearly finished now, if it wasn't for this scheme.
Well, yes, I mean, I take that point, and I mean, there's been a lot of argument about, or a lot of debate about, the fact that, you know, PFI increases the level of investment, and you get things that you wouldn't otherwise have. And the famous phrase which is used is that it's the only show in town. But I think there's another, to look at it in another way is really important. I mean, particularly with hospitals, I mean, you know, spending, you know, £2 billion, in a sense, on a new hospital, when, you know, you could argue that in 20, 25 years' time, when this Southmead is coming towards the end of that contract, there's a major question over whether we will actually need these mega kind of hospitals, and particularly in the terms of the development of telemedicine and development in primary care, primary health care and social care. There's a whole raft of changes taking place which bring into question whether we need to spend this kind of money now on these mega projects. So yes, you get a new hospital, but the question is that actually needed, you know, in the longer term? And would something what, smaller, or, you know, and you know, obviously these big hospitals mean there's a big concentration, centralization of facilities, and there's good parts about that. But there are also questions and disadvantages to that.
I mean, if we were to be a bit patient and wait for our hospital at Southmead, how much more is it costing us to do it the PFI way and borrow the money and then pay it back over a long period of time?
Well, I mean, the basics, you could argue, and it's been shown, I mean, the financial costs, leaving aside any other costs, other issues, but the financial costs of going through the private sector is at least 2% or more. So, you know, if it costs the public sector 5% to borrow the money, then the private sector is borrowing that money at 7%. So, you know, that adds up to many millions of pounds over 30 years.
I think one of the interesting questions is, how much more has the taxpayer paid over the last 20 years than would have needed to be paid if these had been publicly built constructions. And in a period where we're being told all the time that we have to save money, this seems to me to be an enormous drain on taxpayers. And at the same time, these firms that are stepping in to take up private finance initiative contracts are not doing so because they're philanthropists or because they see the bigger picture in terms of state investment in a city or a town, but they're looking simply to make money. And so once again, I think there's a huge political question mark over about the viability of PFI, and the news that some PFIs are going bankrupt should surely make us all realise that this has been a gigantic con trick perpetrated by the last Tory government, maintained and developed by the Labour government, and now being carried on with new vigour by this government. It's a complete rip-off of the taxpayer.
Now, Dexter, can you just talk a bit about the bankruptcy in South London? Because that certainly is worrying. You know, it looks like that someone there has done their financial planning, but they've ended up now in a situation where the whole National Health Service Trust has had to go to the government and say, we've run out of money.
Yes, and as I said before, there's a group of six trusts which, in a sense, have had major problems with PFI projects, and I mean, in a sense, are being bailed out by to the tune of about £1.5 billion between them, because of the size of the what they call the unitary payment, the revenue payments that they're having to make because of that. I think the another side to this, there's one trust which has already done it, and there's another trust which is talking about doing it. On Teesside, one trust has actually bought itself out of the PFI contract because they realised, I can't remember exactly how long the PFI had been going, but probably 6 or 7 years, but they realised that it was going to be cheaper for them in the long term to get out of that contract. So they paid a lump sum, so the private sector still gets its money in a way, but it was still cheaper for them to do that. And another trust in the North Carlisle Hospital, the North Carlisle NHS Trust, is now negotiating with Northumberland County Council to, in a sense, borrow something like £100 million to again buy itself out of the trust, out of the PFI contract. It's getting completely crazy.
Well, maybe PFIs will at some point run their course if there are more bankruptcies. But you're doing a report now, you were telling me on the phone during the week. So what's that all about?
What I'm doing is a final report looking at over 200 examples where I've got the profits. Information about profit levels obtained by the construction companies like Carillion and others, where they've been selling the equity in contracts. I mean, what basically happens, and Southmead is no different, they set up the hospital company, Southmead Limited, is the company which is a special purpose company which is set up by Carillion and the Bank of Scotland. Carillion and the Bank of Scotland each own 50% of the hospital company Southmead Limited. Now, what has been happening is that these companies, once the hospital is finished and it's operating, what they're doing is they're selling the equity in that company, in these companies. And not only are they making substantial profits, but most of the equity is being bought by new infrastructure funds which are located not in Britain but in offshore places like Guernsey and Jersey. So a lot of the assets, well, what could happen with Southmead is that the equity, or either not or part or all of that equity, ends up being controlled by an infrastructure fund based for tax reasons obviously in Guernsey or Jersey. And there's over 250 PFI projects now effectively controlled by infrastructure funds based in those offshore territories.
Now, in a recent Daily Mail report, the blame was laid fairly and squarely at the feet of the lazy civil servants, the Daily Mail said, with their attitude of who cares, it's not our money, that they're up against sharp-minded businessmen who have exploited them to full advantage. The result, apparently, according to the Mail, is that taxpayers have been monstrously overcharged, with PFI liabilities officially estimated in 2010 at a devastating $267 billion. The Mail goes on, and this is in their comments section, their leader. So we are billed for schools long after they close. We pay treble the market price for RAF refuelling planes, and the South London NHS Trust goes bankrupt, unable to pay PFI fees of £61 million every year, with 20 other NHS trusts in deep trouble.
Yes, and you know, by the year, towards the end of the Southmead contract, the Southmead Trust is going to be paying £95 million a year. So, I mean, you know, there are enormous sums of money, and I agree in part with those comments, but I don't think it's to do with about lazy civil servants. I disagree with that totally. You know, what we're dealing with is an industry which is developed around PFI, which is very powerful, there are major companies, there are all the major consultancies. I mean, I call PFI a wealth machine, because if you look at who's making money out of it, the construction companies, the facilities management companies that provide the services, it's all the major consultants and all the major lawyers. It's like a big trough, and they're all deeply into that trough because it is so financially advantageous to them. And side by side with that, I think it's not so much the civil servants that are lazy or whatever. It's a political consensus that this is an easy way out. It's like buying on your credit. It's using your credit card to buy a new car, and yes, you have to pay monthly payments, but the whole debt never appears on your credit card. So all you do is pay so much a month, and you know, it's like, you know, goes back to what you were saying. It's about the only show in town, and it's been portrayed and sold on that basis. That it's an easy way of finance, and you, in a sense, what we're doing is passing the problem on to people who are going to be running the North Bristol Trust in 5 or 10 years' time, and we're passing a debt problem on to future generations.
Now, are you surprised? I mean, I heard yesterday that the finance director at the North Bristol NHS Trust is leaving. Apparently, it's nothing to do with the fact that he's not necessarily wants to be around when the chickens come home to roost for the Southmead Hospital. But does that surprise you that the finance director of North Bristol NHS Trust is leaving at this stage?
No, I think you look at what happens. There is a big churning or a big turnaround of people who've been involved in that project, and that's happened in an awful lot of PFI projects where people, you know, adopt a position. I know there's lots of chief executives in local authorities who've, you know, claimed that the PFI, certain PFI projects are going to be, you know, be the saviour. And are going to be, you know, have a major influence and make savings and all kinds of things. But then, you know, as soon as those projects really start operating, people realise that it's not a golden goose, and they move on rapidly.
Now, you were taking issue with the Mail blaming civil servants, really, saying that it's the sharp-minded businessmen really should be blamed for dodgy PFI contracts, if any exist. But I wonder if you agree with this comment by the Mail in the same piece, saying that the Coalition's duty is to re-examine all 700 PFI contracts to root out abuses.
Well, excuse me. I think that should happen. But I don't think it is going to happen, And I think when the government announces this new kind of PFI model, what is going to happen is that that new model will apply to all future projects, but I don't believe there's going to be any attempt to renegotiate those existing 750 contracts. For a start, it would cost millions and millions in lawyers' fees, and you know, the argument will be made is that we can't afford that, and what is, and that, you know, and we're turning over a new leaf, so all new projects will be in this new model sort of thing. I'm virtually convinced that that would be the case. I mean, I would argue that they should be re-examined, and you know, there is an opportunity to terminate lots of projects, as some have already been terminated. But I don't think that is going to happen.
Okay,
Dexter, finally, could you just tell us whereabouts would be a good place to go to, maybe online, to find out more about PFIs and to actually educate ourselves, maybe to try and educate some of our trustees of our NHS trusts before they put their signature to these deals?
Well, I mean, you could start, the European Services Strategy website has got quite a lot of stuff. There's an outsourcing and PPP library on that site, which has got a set of arguments about, you know, PFI in general. It's got examples of PFI failures and so on, and it's also got more detailed reports about some of the things I've been talking about today.
Now, what is the difference between a PPP and a PFI?
I keep using those terms. I mean, there isn't any real difference.
Okay, so it's a sort of updated name for it.
Yes, I mean, if you want to not to call something, I mean, PFI has got is a term which has got a liability to it now. So if you want to, you know, and what's happened in other countries, there is some small financial differences between the two models. But basically they are the same for all intents and purposes, and a PPP, public-private partnership, is just a more generic term and a broader term that is used to describe them, and it's a way of avoiding using PFI.
Well, Dexter Whitfield, thank you very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Thank you.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, that was Dexter Whitfield there on PFIs, and thanking him very much. Robin Clapp from Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance is still here, though. Robin, ultimately, a PFI deal, I mean, you know, we're not going to get our hospitals and we're not going to get our schools unless we do these deals, are we?
Well, this raises a wider question, doesn't it? What bill are we being asked to pick up for services which, in any civilised society, should be owned by and produced by the public sector? This is a huge tax rip-off. The companies are going to go for PFI, of course they are. What we should be looking at is a political conspiracy where successive governments have chosen a method of building hospitals, schools, police stations that is two or three times more expensive than need have been the case. And it's partly ideological, because the governments are throwing money at these private firms because otherwise they can't get these private firms to invest in. But if the PFI was bad enough, then we've seen also now the emergence of the full-blown private sector coming into the NHS, with people like Richard Branson taking over hospitals, wanting to actually run them purely for profit. It's an absurd world when a hospital can have the word limited at the end of its name. Hospitals are there to care for people and ensure that people are healthy, not to make profit for PFI companies. And certainly, as far as the Anti-Cuts Union is concerned, we will continually be campaigning against these attempts to develop PFIs to allow the private sector to come into health and education as well, for that matter.
So you see it as almost as a sort of Trojan horse, really, where they're coming into public sector areas that the private sector hasn't been before.
Oh, it's absolutely a Trojan horse. These people really can't see any other avenues for investment, and so the government is giving over huge dollops of the public sector to these firms, and it's partly ideological, but it's partly practical for this government. They want to let their private sector buddies have their grubby little hands on our hospitals.
Well, so much of this comes back to money, doesn't it? And we say on this show fairly regularly that money and the banking sector is in a way a kind of utility which really should be managed by the government. They wouldn't be able to then say, oh, we can't afford this, we can't afford that. And is it really normal, acceptable for the sorts of facilities which are used to build hospitals to be in the private sector?
Well, I think our last speaker illustrated that the amount that has been spent on PFI, roughly two or three times more than needed to be spent if those hospitals had been built through public money, would probably be more than sufficient to wipe out the deficit. So we have to say that governments of successive character should be in the dock for wasting money. And the money clearly is there when they want to give huge bribes to their private sector friends to come in and build hospitals.
And we're also
that being used to build services that we need?
Well, we're also hearing about commercial confidentiality in these decisions being made, big decisions now within the NHS trusts here in Bristol. But just how trustworthy are our banks, and are they doing their proper accounting? Let's go over now to Press TV, which is banned here in Britain. Ofcom banned it about 3 or 4 months ago because of some inaccuracies. Now, I don't think it's fair to say that we have quite a lot of inaccuracies on our British media, but the BBC, as far as I know, hasn't been banned yet here in Britain. So we go over to Press TV now and have a listen to former banker Michael Hudson. I mean, I suppose you can get excited listening to this, knowing that the actual TV channel Press TV has now been banned by Ofcom. It comes from the Iranian capital, Tehran, and here's Michael Hudson, the former banker, being interviewed.
You think you have savings, you have an IOU, but the IOU can't be paid. And that's the situation that the economy is in. There are a lot, the backing for the savings is only a fraction, maybe a half, maybe 40% of what savers actually imagine they have. They're backed by about 2% collateral to 20% collateral. They're based by insufficient collateral. There's some there, but there has been so much fraud as a result of deregulation that nobody has any idea how much collateral is there, because economic reporting and seemingly empirical statistics have become fictitious.
Robin, what do you make of that? He's basically saying that the banks don't actually have the money. Our savings is in the bank, but if all of us came along together to get them, the banks would go bankrupt. And they've only got something like 2% in some cases, or up to the maximum of 40% of what they're supposed to have. They've been doing other things with it.
Well, that's been the case for a long, long time. The banks never keep all the deposits in their safe. You know, that passed away with Captain Mannering and the days of Dad's Army. But the worrying thing is what they're doing with those savings. They're not using them to invest in infrastructural projects that would benefit ordinary people. They're not investing in developments that would aid people in Africa against climate change and so on. What they're doing is mucking around with derivatives, with credit default swaps and all these other bits of paper to make more money for themselves. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling money machine. And that's why the banks cannot be left in private ownership, because these people have no shame. They have no loyalty to a particular country. They transfer money across the world. They asset strip. They engage in PFIs if they think that's a lucrative little market. And at the end of the day, they're utterly unaccountable. So if you take all those reasons together, why on earth are we as a society letting these so-called masters of the universe behave in this way, when the last time they were let free, they brought the economy to the brink of a world recession? And by the way, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, he's going to be working 110% to get the economy going. It doesn't sound as though he's very good at maths. And also, I see yesterday that Michael Gove was saying there's 21 school playing fields been sent closed down. 30 have actually been sawed off. So the Tory government need to go back to school to do some sums as well.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, US-owned First Group, who prompted passenger revolts here on the Paddington service, they pipped Virgin Trains to the post. And Richard Branson has been saying this week that the system's unfair. Now, BCFM's Steve Satan pops in. He's the national spokesperson for Rail Futures. Hi, Steve. Welcome to Drive Time.
How are you doing?
Now, first of all, paying more than ever taxpayers' money to subsidise railways. We were told, when railways were privatised, that actually what was going to happen was we were going to be paying less. We're now paying more every year, and also the rail fares are going up over inflation for the last 10 years.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt that that's true. I mean, the subsidies are much greater than they ever were under British Rail, and I think whilst the individual train operating companies may themselves be quite efficient, the complexity of the system, the amount of lawyers exchanging contracts and so on, inevitably leads to greater costs across the system, and that's why we're paying more.
So how has this all been allowed to happen? It sounds like a bit of a racket. Every time we get on a train, it's almost like the mafiosi are taking over and they're taking their cut. Actually, it's not necessarily the mafia, it's more the shareholders of these operating companies.
Yeah, and what else has happened is that the government is trying to contribute less and less to the costs of running the railways, and what that means is that's why year on year we have inflation busting rail fares.
Well, funnily enough, the fuel prices are going up too, aren't they? So if you wanted to say, well, I'd rather use my car for this journey, you're paying more at the pump.
Well, there's an interesting comparison there, actually, that this autumn the government were due to put up the price of petrol above inflation, and they backed down on that. And yet it's quite okay to have inflation busting, you know, rail fares. I think, you know, if they want to be fair to both parties, they should back down from inflation busting ticket prices in January.
This US-owned train operator First Group, who've been running the service from Bristol down to Penzance and up to Paddington, who are these people?
I don't know, some company. I mean, it doesn't really matter, does it?
Because it's a US company, I know quite often foreign governments, and our government as well with British companies, they actually give them a little bit of a helping hand. They say, well, we actually like the idea of our companies doing business abroad. So do we know if First Group have had a little bit of help with this? Because they seem to have bid way over the odds, at least according to Richard Branson. He's saying, well, there's no way that we could ever bid that amount because we could never make money. So how have they managed to do that, do you think?
I don't know. Richard Branson, obviously, you would expect him to sort of make a bit of a song and dance and cry foul and so on, but he's not the only one suggesting that First Group have overbid for this. What they've bid is equivalent to £1 million a day, which is what they have to pay for the government before they even think about running, you know, the actual cost of running the railway. And they also say that they're going to reduce fares at the same time. Now, clearly, that doesn't quite stack up. So either they've got to make huge efficiency savings, which I doubt is likely, or something else is going on. Maybe they're going to increase fares elsewhere.
Now, they've had also this McNulty report, which is... I don't really know much about McNulty, apart from the fact that he was in charge of our airports when the roofs were leaking and people were having to put buckets under to collect the water from the airports. And he's done a report on the railways. How is that also going to affect things over the next couple of years? McNulty.
Well, McNulty was brought in because it was realised that the cost of, you know, British railways as a whole, not the old British Rail, but the British railway system, was much higher than the equivalents in Europe. And so something must be going on. And McNulty was asked to look into that. But interestingly, he was specifically banned from saying, well, it's all down to privatisation. He had to sort of take privatisation as read and then see if he could find ways of making savings. Now, he claims to have found a few. He reckons he can save like £1 billion or 2 billion a year. But there are fears that these savings actually amount to cuts. And I think, you know, we should have really been clear, or the government should be clear, that they're looking for efficiency savings. If they want efficiency savings, I define that as providing the same service for less money. Anyone can cut offices and cut trains and cut services to save a few quid, and clearly that's in no one's interest.
Now, let's just bring Robin in. Robin, what are your thoughts about what's been going on in our railway system? Because, I mean, the thing that I think is the bottom line here is that we're now paying far, far more as taxpayers towards the railways than we were before privatisation.
Well, as I understand it, three times as much subsidy as was the case.
Is that right,
Steve?
Roughly?
Three times. I can't put a figure on it, but certainly a lot more. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, excuse the pun, Tony, but this news this week is a rail crash waiting to happen. I mean, there's no winner for this news. I mean, I've no you know, great love of Richard Branson, but I think he has pointed out that the bid appears on the surface to be wholly incompatible with reality, and therefore First will, through a combination of cuts or through putting the prices up in other parts of his franchise, seek to continue this. But what happens if they go bust halfway through? What happens if the contract isn't met? Once again, you've got contracts being given out by the government like confetti to firms which offer lots of promises and sugar-coated statements. But where's the protection for the travelling public? Where's the protection for the rail workers themselves? And where's the protection and guarantee that there will be improvements to the railways? It's a deal that once again shows that privatisation is not in the interest of ordinary people who use the railways, and we need a publicly owned rail network and rail train operators.
Now, Steve, the Labour Party has actually talked within the last couple of months about the possibility of renationalising the railways. Is that something that Rail Futures wants to see, or what?
No, Rail Futures' position is that we have to sort of start from where we are rather than, you know, fantasising about what the ideal would be. I mean, I think most people would agree that rail privatisation was badly botched, and there's still a lot of problems with the system. But renationalisation may not necessarily be the best way.
Well, what they're saying, Labour Party, is it's actually going to be cheaper for the Department of Transport if they renationalise it.
Well, that may be the case. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, but I'm saying it's not necessarily the automatic conclusion that you should come to.
Okay. What about the reason that we're in this situation in the first place, which is the cuts in back in the 1950s and the 1960s in our railway network? How would it, do you think, affect the ability of the railway network to deliver the transport needs that we want, places to go to that we want to go to, if the network was extended back to what it was before the beaching cuts?
Well, I mean, certainly there are many, many lines that were cut during the beaching era and some before and after that should never have been cut. I mean, beaching got it wrong on so many levels. I mean, obviously there are some sort of rail enthusiasts who just on principle object to any railway being shut. And clearly there were some, you know, hopeless dead losses that should never have been opened in the first place. But what bothers me, I can forgive railway lines being closed. What I can't forgive is them being sold off and being built on so that we haven't got the option of reopening them again.
Well, what about some of our local lines? The Severn Beach line seems to have done reasonably well over the last few years.
Well, the Severn Beach line is a fantastic example of where, when you invest in a rail network, the passengers will come and use it. And there are many, many other examples, mostly actually not in England, but in Wales and Scotland, like the Ebble Vale line and the Airdrie Bathgate line and so on, where these lines have been reopened and they've been hugely successful.
Okay, what about the Portishead line? What's happening with that? Is that going to be reopened? Because as this is one everyone's talking about, it's there's a wonderful train line already there. It's not even as if they've got to relay the track or something, and there's weeds growing where the track used to be.
Well, they will have to relay the last couple of tracks and of miles of track and resignal it. But yeah, you're right. The line is basically there, and it's a relatively simple case to reopen it, and it has such a strong case as well. You know, Portishead is one of the largest towns in the country without a rail service. It takes you during rush hour well over an hour to drive into Bristol, and the train would take just 17 minutes. So the case is absolutely overwhelming, and it's very frustrating that the sort of levels of bureaucracy required to sort of get it reopened are just immense. Whereas, you know, it seems that if they want to build a new road scheme, it's bang, 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 money, no object.
So anyway, who are the people who've been pushing over the years for the increase of motorways and that kind of thing? Are the roads lobby? Who are these people?
Well, they're people who have an interest in promoting road, and that could include you know, the oil companies, the actual freight operators themselves, road builders, and the classic example, of course, going back to beaching. We all think of beaching as the bad guy, but I think the real villain of the piece was Marples, who was Minister of Transport and
Conservative
Minister of Transport, and at the same time owned shares in a road building company.
Well, he didn't just own shares; he had the name on the side of the road company,
Marples Ridgeway. Yeah,
Marples Ridgeway, who were the motorway building firm. So, I mean, I've got a bit of theory, which is someone emailed to me a few weeks ago about beaching, and this was a simple thing, which was North Sea Oil was coming on stream in the 50s. It was known about, they were talking about doing it, but the powerful oil companies, particularly in the US, were saying, well, look, if you're going to be digging up oil from the North Sea in Britain, we don't want you selling it around the world, because this is going to actually depress the price of oil, so you've got to expand your market. Is that one conspiracy theory too far, do you think? Because they were saying that if you develop your oil market at the home market, then you can use that at North Sea Oil and sell it at home, and you won't depress the international oil price, which the Americans like to think they control.
Well, I mean, I think in the big scheme of things, Britain's oil consumption is not that significant. So I just can't believe that building a few more roads would use up so much more oil that they would
But between the early 60s and the late 70s, just about every suburban road with houses along it in this country got covered with cars, didn't it?
Well, that's
over those
two
decades.
But that probably would have happened anyway without beaching, you know. And it was happening in every country in the world. So it would have been easy as well for the government just to slightly slow down production just to bump up prices. So I just don't buy that one.
Okay. What about the local rapid transit scheme? You were here a couple of months ago talking about that. How's that all developing? And is it going the way you want it to go?
Well, I attended many of the sessions of the public inquiry, and it was, you know, strikingly obvious to me that it's just an insane turkey of a scheme that is going to blow £50 million for absolutely zero transport benefits. Absolutely none.
Well, hang on a minute, because we've been talking about a tram for years. We haven't managed to have this. This is a sort of halfway house. Surely there's going to be some benefits from it.
I'm unaware of them. I mean, the whole point is that it takes an existing bus service and diverts it through this guided channel, but it's the same buses going to the same destinations, and that's going to cost you £50 million, and the bus companies aren't going to be prepared to pay for the privilege of going down the guided channel, so the city council are going to be left with the liability of maintaining this white elephant. It's just such a stupid idea. Whoever dreamt it up wants their arse kicking from one end of the Harbour Railway to the other.
Okay, now, what timetable are we looking at?
Well, the public inquiry...
And whereabouts are we going to see it in the city?
The public inquiry will probably announce its decision in a couple of months' time, and then, I don't know, maybe a couple of years of construction while they rip up the Harbour Railway, pointlessly, and make the beautiful harbour side into a bus lane. But anyway, and then in, I don't know, 2 or 3 years' time, it may happen, and what people will see is, as like I say, their existing bus from Western Supermare to the city centre, or from the park and ride out by Long Ashton, will take a different route into the city centre, but it won't be any quicker. It might even be slower.
Okay, Steve, where else do we find Rail Futures? Do you have a membership, anything like that?
Of course we do, yeah. We're a membership voluntary campaigning organisation. It's railfuture.org.uk.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, this is the latest book in front of me, dropped through the letterbox this week, from an author from the from Australia called John Morgan. It's called The Paris-London Connection, and it's all about the death of Princess Diana. I'm going to ask our guest, Robin Clapp from the Anti-Cuts Alliance, to comment if he wants to afterwards, but I'm just going to read a little quote out from it. This is really looking at the death of Diana and many of the circumstances surrounding it, which John Morgan has been digging up, all from official sources, that is, things like the transcripts to the inquest and various investigations that were done in France and Britain into Diana's death. This is a chapter called Flying Free. This is when Diana was actually free from the royal family and she was no longer an HRH. Anyway, it says here, then during the following month, February 1997, Diana received a threatening phone call at her home in Kensington Palace. Her friend Simone Simmons was there and writes, "I was with Diana in her sitting room at Kensington Palace when she beckoned me over and held her large old-fashioned black telephone away from her ear so that I could hear. I heard a voice telling her she should stop meddling with things she didn't understand or know anything about, and spent several minutes trying to tell her to drop her anti-landmines campaign. Diana didn't say much, she just listened, and I clearly heard the warning. You never know when an accident is going to happen. Diana went very pale. The moment she put the phone down, we started talking about what he had said. I tried to be reassuring, which was not easy. She was clearly very worried. When I listened to her conversation with its apparent warning, I was not sure of her safety anymore. The conversation frightened Diana, and it certainly scared me. Diana told Simmons that the caller was the Minister of the Armed Forces and close, long-time friend of Prince Charles, Nicholas Soames, the same person who just 14 months earlier had accused Diana on national TV of being in the advanced stages of paranoia. Dinah was not deterred and said to Simmons, "It doesn't matter what happens to me. We must do something. We cannot allow this slaughter to continue." Now, Robin, this is just an extract from this book, which is out this week. Quite small, easy to read. What are your thoughts about the sort of political angle on Dinah? Because certainly there's been a lot of suppression of some of the criticism of the royals with regards to the way she died.
Yes, there has, and there remain lots and lots of questions. Very difficult to establish any answers. The establishment clearly felt Dinah was a liability. Did they organise to have Dinah murdered? That isn't something that I think is compelling. Maybe reading that book may change my mind.
How important, though, do you think the royals are? Because, I mean, they're very much in the background. The Prime Minister goes to see the Queen every week, and there is a sort of loose connection. But, do the royals really still have any power? Or are they more symbolic?
I think the royals have an enormous value for the capitalists in this country, in that whenever there is a national crisis, they can be put before the television screens. We have hourly bulletins about Prince Philip's bladder, very, very sad, he's in hospital, but there are many, many other elderly people who never get a mention on the national news. The royals can be a huge distraction. They can be a way of making people feel that they are part of a Britain where we're all in it together. And of course, the Queen still has reserve powers, powers to sack governments. And we saw in the 1970s how the Queen used those powers to sack a radical Labour Prime Minister in Australia. So whilst I think on one level that the Queen is a feudal hangover, nevertheless, they keep her and her family in place, paid for by our taxes, for a very good reason, and that is that they can be very useful to the people who run society. And of course, you and I, Tony, probably won't get invited to a garden party for saying all this, but I think that the reality is that Dinah was an embarrassment to the royal family, and I've no doubt, even if they didn't have a hand in their killing, that they did wish she could be out of the picture. And of course, ironically, by killing her, she's remained in the public eye in a different way, and books like this seek to bring to the attention of people that there are unanswered questions.
Well, one of the things that disturbs me, I wonder what your view is on this, is the Keith Allen film, Unlawful Killing, which is about a 30-minute film, which was funded by Al-Fayed, but was the idea was this was an Al-Fayed point of view documentary into, the number one, the failings of the actual inquest, and number two, some of the evidence that his family had come up with about what had happened. What are your thoughts about the fact that that's actually now not going to be shown here in Britain at all?
Not surprised about that. Once again, we live in a society where things that they don't want you to know about are kept away from us, and that's why people like Julian Assange, to go back to him, are very irritating for the powers that be, because they lift the lid on some of the murky goings on in this society. I think there are many, many scandals we never get to hear about. Those we do get to hear about, of course, come about often as a result of the actions of courageous journalists. We wouldn't have heard about the phone hacking inquiry had it not been for the actions of a few dedicated journalists. And there are many other scandals probably still being concealed at the moment. And it's the job of anybody with the interests of truth at heart to open the lid and let us know what really goes on in this country.
Well, one other thing is I certainly, for one, am absolutely convinced that Dodi and Diana, when they came back to London, were going to announce their engagement, not least of which Dodi had just spent $200,000 on a ring for Diana just after a holiday with Harry and William that they'd just come back from. Well, that's all the serious talk out of the way now, because Friday night is music night, kicking off with 2 hours live with Spike and Rodsey, and also this week with Pat Hart too, who's back from his holidays. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem councillor for St George West and former Lord Mayor Chris Davis, also to PFI consultant Dexter Whitfield, and to Steve Satan, who's a spokesperson for the campaign group Rail Futures. And you just heard there from Robin Clapp from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. Next week, Now, well, there's a by-election in Bradley Stoke on Saturday the 8th of September. We thrash out some of the issues between UKIP and Conservative candidates. And also Bristol Remploy employing scores of local disabled workers. Those workers will be here to tell us whether or not they will be on the dole. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times. Just go to thisweek.org.uk. Every BCFM show is available online. Just go to bcfm.org.uk for all the other shows, but thisweek.org.uk takes you to this show. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Leave you now in the capable hands of the Fresh Blood crew.
Everybody knows it. Wah, 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 wah. Well, call me 99s and we are big up with chess. Chess, blood, spicy, yes, you know we are the best. We are champions. When we are the best, we are champions. Yeah. We call me 99s and we are big up with chess. Chess, blood, spicy, yes, you know we are the best. We are champions. When we are the best, we are champions. Yeah. Well, all the people. Yeah, my mama with we. Well, all the passes. Yes, you know them agree. We come a party and them a dance with we. And all the DJs say in there all agree. We come in and say we are big up with chess. Big up with chess, cause we know we are the best. We are champions. We are the dance, we are champions, yeah. Big up with chess,